You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Minutes after 8 here on the last radio show before Christmas. Joining me from Africa is David J. Furness, Brigadier General, United States Marine Corps. So, Merry Christmas, man. What's going on?
Well, Merry Christmas to you, too. Doing what we do here in sub-Saharan Africa.
So you're working for who?
AFRICOM Commander.
AFRICOM Commander. Okay.
Right.
And so can you describe the region that AFRICOM is responsible for?
Yeah, I thought the whole African continent with the exception of Egypt. Egypt is in CENTCOM. So.
Okay.
I think that's 53 countries. And my part of it is 11 countries in East Africa that are assigned to the, I don't know if you call it supervision, of Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa. So we cover down on Sudan, South Sudan, Eritrea, Djibouti, where we're located at Camp Lunanye, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Somalia, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, and Kenya.
Wow. Is Africa a pretty place?
Yeah, most of it is. I mean, I wouldn't say Djibouti looks like 29 palms with a bunch of trash bags blown around. But
we love that look.
Yeah. So, but, you know, as the... again, the... You have the Horn with, you know, Somalia, the northern part of Somalia, Djibouti, and then South Sudan is very green, lush, and then as you move towards Khartoum, it becomes more like Egypt, you know, where you have a belt around the Nile, but other than that, it's pretty, dry. And then the Great Lakes region, pretty much defined, is, you know, Western Ethiopia, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Western Kenya, Western Tanzania is, you know, it's cool, it's elevation, it's from 5 to 9,000 feet, rains a lot, green, very beautiful.
The you know, obviously much in the news has been what happened, the incident where four special forces soldiers were killed. Can I ask you general questions about, not about that incident, but about Al-Qaeda's presence and other what we would call Islamic actors or organizations on that continent? Is general description, are they there? Or is their presence increasing? Do you see greater attempts at recruitment, at establishing a presence there? Talk to us about, you know, and, you know, again, people have been talking for years that, you know, that the fight that we fight in other parts of the world is going to Africa. And that I remember the Marine, and, you know, the discussion about, you know, about the Horn of Africa and the Marine Corps needed a presence there, blah, 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 blah. So, can you make us smart about your battle space?
Well, I mean, and of course, right across the Bab el-Mandeb, which is the straits, the choke point of the Red Sea that goes in the Gulf of Aden, you got Yemen. Okay, so you got a failed state where you have Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So AQAP, you got ISIL, Yemen, and so then obviously there's flow of support there from, you know, ISIL Bane, Al Qaeda Bane, which I think is still probably in the Pakistan mountains somewhere. So you've got movement of illicit, you know, fighters, money, and other resources going into the Arabian Peninsula. That also comes across into this battle space. I mean, Africa's got several hot zones, I would call them. In Somalia, you got Al-Shabaab. And you also have a small Somalia.
Wait, Al-Shabaab is where?
It's in Somalia, okay?
Okay.
Pretty much Al-Shabaab.
Right.
They used to control most of Somalia, but they've been pushed into the probably lower two-thirds, principally in the Juba River Valley now, which is in very southern Somalia, east or west of the port of Kismayo. They don't own Kismayo anymore. They don't own Mogadishu. They don't own most of the major cities. The African Union mission in Somalia, which encompasses Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, Burundi, and Djiboutian troops, that kind of cleared them out of the major urban hubs. But they do in the hinterlands still control our territory. So they are an Al Qaeda affiliate. And, so they pledged allegiance to Al Qaeda. And so they're the principal target of this headquarters. You know, we don't have a targeting role per se. We support the people who do that. And then you have Libya, of course. You have a variety of actors there. And then you have the Lake Chad Basin and you have Boko Haram. As you get more towards West Africa, you also have Al Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, which, you know, moves, I think, probably north-south from, you know, Libya and Algeria, Tunisia, down into the Lake Chad Basin, Mali, and areas like that. So there's a lot on that. Those are the principal hotspots that AFRICOM kind of covers down on. And it's challenging because we're not a priority theater. We're an economy of force theater. So the resources that you have are not as robust as one might have, say, in Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan. And so you're trying to go by with and through partners, local partners, in the Lake Chad Basin, in the Sahel region. You know, we support mostly French actions. They're probably the lead actor there. We're supporting them with activity. But you go by with and through local partners or another partner like either the French or AMISOM in the case of Somalia to try to get at the problem and, you know, pooling resources and working together to roll back these organizations and, you know, keep them at least isolated or, in fact, attrit them to where they cannot threaten the U.S. homeland.
One of the things that we've seen, a piece of the fallout of the investigation and just stray voltage stuff is a headline, I want to say a couple weeks ago, that that armed drones were now authorized for use in Africa. Drones obviously have become, you know, as every year goes by, they become a more and more integral piece of what, you know, U.S. forces do around the world. Explain how to use those things in AFRICOM? You know, is it where we're partnered? Can you give us some idea of how those assets get used?
Well, you know, armed ISR is a high demand, low density asset,
right.
And so they are apportioned, you know, based on a global priority. So first of all, AFRICOM there's a much higher demand. We'd like to have more armed CAPs, they call them, than we have. But you know, we compete for those with, you know, CENTCOM, which has a variety of things going on. So,
right.
You know, it's kind of a zero sum game at this point. It's not so much the asset, the flying thing, it's the PED, it's the bandwidth, the control is. So, we get our share and then AFRICOM apportions them out and, to those places I just, discussed they go to work. So, our special operations forces of various flavors use them, to target, HVIs and, elements of these violent extremist organizations, we call it, Islamic jihadis, if you want to call it, but all the ones, you know, Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda, and the Islamic Maghreb, Boko Haram, various different, you know, ISIL flavors throughout the continent. So there's a same targeting process similar to how you're familiar, how we did it in Helmand in 10-11.
Right.
You know, the triggers are much more precise and, you know, the appetite for any collateral damage is not there. So you cannot shoot if, you know, you're going to threaten women and children. So those things are up in the air looking. And when we have the clearance to fire based on specified rules of engagement, then, you know, they fire and they're very accurate. And there's a very good track record of hitting who we want to hit and not hurting anybody else. So,
Email question for you. Mac, what is the fight about in Africa? Pretty basic question.
In where?
What's the fight about?
In Africa?
Yeah, in Africa. What's the fight about?
Well, I mean, I think the organizations I've just described are terrorist organizations that have global reach.
Right.
And so we're trying to help partners deal with the security in their country so that they can take care of these. So ungoverned spaces can become governed spaces. So this is a State Department, Defense Department fight. And the kinetic aspect of it is you target leadership. You provide capabilities that those local forces do not possess. Okay, so they don't fly Preds and Reapers. And so we will do that in support of them. Our special operations forces give advice to them to make training so that they can employ themselves better. And so the strategy is by, with, and through those local partners and other allies to get at these organizations that do threaten the homeland one way or the other.
And so is the hope that what we're going to carve out a piece of this country and create terrorist base? We're going to take over the country. Both.
What the terrorists want to do?
Yeah. What is their?
Yeah.
Do they think that that's going to happen?
I think they probably want what ISIL wanted in Syria and Iraq. You know, they want to control territory. A lot of them will cloak themselves in jihadi methodology or language, the trappings of being, a religious movement. But quite honestly, they're organized crime gangs. I mean, they tax, they extort. It's in it for the money. And so if they control population, if they control Kuwait, they can raise money through various means and enrich themselves. So I think, Africa is enormous. Just my little piece, okay, the countries I describe, is like the east coast of the United States from the Mississippi River to the east coast and from Maine to Florida. That's how big it is. So it's a huge continent.
Right.
And so there's lots of spaces that are, not governed very well or not governed at all. These folks tend to pool and then they get their collective act together and they go try to exert control over populations and population center in order to raise money and enrich themselves. I think they may aspire to run the state. So, Al-Shabaab had, at one point in time, ruled from Mogadishu and then wanted to be the Islamic state of Somalia. They threatened the region and, various actors, Ethiopia, Kenya came in and Uganda and knocked them out of Mogadishu. And then Amazon stood up and tried to further reduce them. And, we're still at it, trying to defeat them, so that the federal government of Somalia can take control of all of its territory. I think we're trying to do that again, in Libya. With the different ISIL variants, we're trying to do it in, the Lake Chad Basin, Mali, Niger, all those areas. Same thing. It's just trying to help the local government control its territory. The violent extremist organizations, the terrorists, the insurgents are trying to do the opposite. So it's just it's the same dynamics that we had in Helmand, or we've had in Afghanistan for the last 17 years, President. They are literally insurgent forces using terrorist tactics and terrorist methodologies to exert control over state.
Afghanistan back in the news again with the winding down of operations in Syria and Iraq. Those sorties are going somewhere, and thankfully the Taliban are on the receiving end of that. For you. You had a chance during a year in the Helmand province of Afghanistan to get around and to meet a lot of Afghan leaders. What do they want? How do they see the Taliban? What do they want? Can you explain, from their perspective what they want?
Well, I think overall, they'd like to have peace and stability in their country so they can live their life as, they haven't been able to live for the last 40 years for one reason or another. But, like you said, I've probably met hundreds of Afghans, in that year. Not once did I ever meet an Afghan leader or a local Afghan that wanted America to leave. In fact, it was just the opposite. They wanted us to stay. They kind of don't trust themselves. They knew that that the security wasn't, it hadn't deepened enough to where they could handle the situation. They don't like the Taliban. The Taliban's very, very oppressive, and has things that culturally, at least in the Pashtun belt, are not consistent with Pashtunwali, their cultural code. And so, the harsh, form or variant of Islam is not something that they that they practiced, prior to the Taliban. It was probably superheated a little bit, with the jihad against the Russians and some of the forces that came out of Western Pakistan. But, that's not how that country, was, you know, prior to the Soviet invasion. So I would think the normal Afghan would like to get back to some stability in their lives, you know, security, peace, so that they can send their kids to school, they can either farm or do their trades in their villages or cities and live their life, you know, pretty much like everybody else. They're hardworking people. I mean, it's a hard life in that part of the world, and they work hard just to survive. So they don't really, they don't really like all the added attention that comes from, you know, having people like NATO and the Americans fighting the Taliban and ISIL now in the far eastern parts of the country.
So, how did they? What was their view about growing poppy? Was it something that they didn't want to do? That they would rather not do? Was it something they were content to grow and export? What was it? Because I mean, the crop you hear that gets cited is pomegranate. Could bring a similar rate of return on investment for farmers there. But what was their take on the whole poppy thing?
Well, the business model was hard to beat. And,
right.
You know, the Taliban would go around and give these poor farmers, first of all, there's two planting seasons there. So they didn't plant poppy all the time. They planted it in one of their two seasons. And so they'd spread the seeds out. They don't need much water, which is good for that part of the world. They don't need a lot of tending. You don't have to sit there and pull weeds and stuff like that. And then the poppy grows, it matures, and then the Taliban comes around and scores the bulb, harvests the crop, you know, pays you the money and leave, takes the product and goes. So, you know, we're trying to get them to plant wheat, and you plant wheat, it needs a lot of water. You got to do a lot of tending. You got to find a market. You know, you got to sell it, not somebody else comes and pays you for it right off the bat. And you got to, you know, separate the kernels from the stalks and everything. So there's a lot more work involved in wheat, and it brings a far, far, far lower return on the investment. So it's, you know, if we weren't going to use something like we do with Farmers United States, like price supports,
right?
It'd be hard to wean them off that because they're dirt poor. I mean, we can't even envision how poor they are. So part of it is they would give them a little bag of wet opium that was like their bank account. If they needed, you know, somebody needed surgery or medical care, they could turn that in at a market for money and trade it for, you know, an operation or something. So for them, because it never goes bad, that's another thing.
Nice.
It's just, and, you know, the Taliban is pushing it, and so from their point of view, they're not using it. While some do, most don't, and they're exporting it to somebody else, you know. So, hey, not my problem from their point of view, and they make a lot of money from it. So, it's going to be a hard one to beat.
Let me ask you, so
because it's so easy.
So, the Taliban scores it. You harvest it. They pick it up. They take off. Once the Taliban goes away, does that become a private commercial enterprise that does the same thing and supplants
to sustain the
revenue?
You know, there's right. I think there's going to be criminal organizations that are going to, because you make a lot of money from them,
right.
You know. So obviously, you know, the bottom line is if nobody was using it in Europe, they wouldn't have a market for it. Most of American heroin comes from Mexico. I mean, like all of it. So most of this heroin or opium goes to Europe and the Middle East. So if there wasn't a market, if people weren't shooting it in their veins, they wouldn't be planting it. But they are, and it's very lucrative. And again, if you're doing two planting seasons and you're going to do like cotton and opium, you know, you can make a living for a family of, you know, and you saw it as you were driving around out there, and people had 10, 15 kids, you gotta put food on the table and stuff, so they live a hard life out there in the hinterland, especially in Helmand Province. And so I think there's always going to be a market for it. So if the Taliban goes away, someone else will move in that void and move it, you know, in the first echelon of, okay, we're going to take the wet opium away from you. Thank you very much. Here's your money. And then we're going to process it someplace into black tar and then move it again someplace else. So
somebody would supplant the Taliban if you make them go away because obviously of the commercial value of the crop.
The only thing that would help the state is if you had a functioning state that could come in and control the territory, and then you would have to manage the agricultural sector of Afghanistan so that the average farmer could make a living with other crops. If you did that, you could probably wean people off of it. But there's always going to be nefarious actors that say, hey, we're going to plant this. Okay, you're going to plant it. And the little guy out there where the state has a problem extending its writ is going to go, okay, I'll do it.
The one thing I've learned about farmers, both in the United States and abroad, they can add. Okay.
They're
good at math. They sit down and you talk to them and they do a few quick calculations and then they start nodding their head or not, but they can add.
I
love this notion of, well, you know, peace in our time and we can get them to grow something else. Well, the amount of money that throws off pays everybody, the police chief not to screw with it, right? The governor.
The guy who's making the most money is not the farmer.
Right. No, without a doubt.
He's making more than he'd make with any other crop.
Right.
So to him, it's a lucrative business. And then the guy that, you know, the nefarious actor who's moving it and paying the police chief off and moving it to the guy who's going to process it and further up the chain, that's where the money's been.
Email. Mac, interesting conversation. And Afghanistan layered on top of AFRICOM. Is Helmand and much of Afghanistan ungoverned?
Well, I haven't been there since 2011, when we were there, was most of it ungoverned? Yeah, it was governed. There was government structures there. I would say they were attempting to govern it, but the writ did not move much far out of the district center, as you know. So did the average Afghan living in, you know, Tenishin or southern Garmshire feel the government? Not really. But I don't know that he ever had. So for him, life's not different.
Right. If he were to be touched by the government, that would be different, yes?
Well, probably, yeah.
No, I mean, in an effective way, you know, a responsive government, it's just, it's kind of like trying to describe, you know, people, the term dirt poor is not a new term. People, Americans know that term, but you really don't know it. Right.
Yeah.
If you go to Afghanistan,
I don't think they can truly appreciate
dirt.
Their poverty level. I mean, it's a struggle every day. You don't know where your next meal's coming from.
There are
no roads.
Do us a favor and describe just a typical farm compound. What does that look like?
You know, you got a mud wall compound about 7 to 10 feet high. At the base, those mud walls may be 3 to 4 feet thick, you know, kind of like a triangle up.
Right, right.
That wall, that compound goes around the whole, you know, it's about, you know, 15, 20 yards wide, 15, 20 yards deep, two or three buildings inside where the family sleeps, where the animals are, if there's a cow or something like that, that's in there as well. The women never come outside the compound after they're probably 13 or so. The farmland is right outside the compound, and it may be a couple hectares, per house. It's manually irrigated, so you have some irrigation canals, and you're, you know, channeling the water, you know, by hand. I mean, digging canals. Damming up canals, directing at other places like you have, you know, for a millennium. And so you flood the, you know, the particular patty, kind of like divided up in like what we would term or kind of know as like rice paddy. You know, so there's dikes and square fields and they control the irrigation from one to another, you know, and, there's like a couple planting seasons. So like I say, not everybody. We reduced greatly and so did the government, from time to time, because if you control the area, they won't plant what they're not supposed to plant pretty much.
Right.
But if you don't, they're going to plant poppy. So they plant poppy there. When it blooms, it's very beautiful. after the petals fall off, it's the problem. Or they'll plant cotton.
Wait, hold on. Describe what you mean when you say, when it blooms, it's very beautiful. Describe the
flowers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's especially when you fly over it. I mean, it's just the different colors of the blossoms are striking. And so when they bloom for a period and then the petals fall off, you got a bulb there and that's what you score to get the opium. But before the petals fall off, you know, they're red and purple and white and different colors and, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of poppy stalks in a poppy field. So it is, you know, they're green stalks and bright colored flowers. It's pretty. You know,
so you're flying
before they fall off.
So you're flying around in some kind of aviation asset and you're looking out the window and you're thinking, good thing we're eradicating this. Or else there'd be so much more of this beautiful. Now, when you talk about, are you seeing like spots here and there of this beautiful pink, you know, explosion of color? Or are you seeing like a lot of it?
Well, like for us, I mean, as you know, we had four battalion sectors in there, and those battalions, and then we had four Kandaks, one Kandak with each battalion. So in our area was rather saturated with security forces between army, police, border police, and whatnot. And so you would fly over our area, there would be spots, but not a lot. As you got north, so in between like our northern, like northern Marja and Leatherneck, there were areas like, because really that was Lashkar Gah and then kind of a no man's land before you got to Leatherneck.
Right.
And if you just fly over uninterrupted fields of color. So it, you know, it kind of was an indicator of, again, the writ of governance, because there was a policy when we were there where the government would go and plow it under. Now you could do that where you could secure that, you know, where the Taliban had maybe more control than you, you couldn't do that. And so it was a good indicator actually of, who held sway. Like you go over Flyover Garmshire, there wasn't any. It's all wheat. You know, I'm not sure they were happy about that.
Right. But it was what it was.
The same thing, like when it was cotton season, you would go, and when the cotton would bloom, you'd fly over there and just be white fields, as far as the eye could see. And, you know, walking through that stuff is pain. Cotton is not your friend. I mean, it's thorn. It's like walking through bunch of rose bushes. I mean, so the Marines hated it. They're just ripping their utilities all to hell, and you know. But again, they had to. I mean, they literally. You'd see families out there, and this is the difference between poppy and cotton. You know, poppy people. You know, Taliban come in and help you harvest it. When it's cotton, you're out there with your 12 kids picking that stuff by hand, like we used to do in the 1800s. And then you're putting in a truck that you have some kind of animal pull to, you know, Garmshire District Center or, you know, Marja District Center, where you have a gin. You know, if you know, I mean, I remember, you know, these guys running the gin in downtown Marja District Center, right down from the district center. This gin's going, and they'd come out looking like a big chicken man because all that, you know, the cotton stuff, they'd be white from head to toe. I'm like, your life expectancy just went down, you know, 10, 50 years. That can't be good for you. And then they put it in bales on the, and load these trucks up, and those trucks would drive to Pakistan.
My guest, Brigadier General David J. Furness, we are Battle Buddies times three, and he joins us here after waking me up at about 4:05 this morning. So I want to say thank you. Can you not tell time? Or, like, what is that?
No, well, yeah. 8 hours. I'm bad at math.
I get this message.
I didn't think you had an answer.
I get this message. What are you doing? I'm sleeping, dumbass. What do you think? It's 4:05.
Right. What? I've been up for like 15 hours.
Why'd you answer then? Oh, really? Now we're just gonna do stupid stuff. Let me read you another email. Ungoverned spaces seem like the death of all of us. It seems very difficult to me. How do we deal with the ungoverned spaces around the world?
That's a really good question.
Is that what the global war on terrorism will ultimately become? Us using special forces to fortify those that are ungoverned. As the years go by, they mature to the extent that they can govern, and then we get in the overwatch business and the fire brigade business, and then move on to the next fight as this thing continues to percolate around the world in this what looks to be no end in sight global war on terrorism.
I think the long-term strategy is buy with and through local partners. We don't have enough.
Right.
We're wearing our special forces out around the globe doing this stuff. So, those guys, we complain about depth of dwell. They're below 1-to-1, all of them. And so I think we have to come to grips to understand what buy with and through means. We have to demand that local partners step up and do their share, that we can facilitate maybe their activities with technology that they don't possess, or we can help train and fund them. But doing what we did in Helmand 10 to 11, we can't sustain that.
Right.
And I think by chasing the boogeyman across the globe, of ungoverned space, you know, I can't count how many countries I've been in, but it's a lot. And what I've come to find out is there's much more poorly governed or ungoverned space than well-governed space. So if we're going to chase the monsters in ungoverned space all the time, we're going to be real busy for a long, long, long time. So we have to come to grips with what is sustainable and moderate that in areas that are that we have a no kidding national interest in. And areas that we don't have a national interest in, I think we're going to have to come to, you know, we may be able to do a lower level of that kind of support. Here's some money. Go fight these guys. You know, here's a mobile training team. We're gone. Or we simply just don't do anything, which I think we're loath to do. But, you know, we can't go searching the world for monsters because we'll find them everywhere. And we don't have the resources to do this forever. And we're going to bankrupt ourselves if we do. That's my opinion. But these are long, long, long struggles. We should help local forces again, but that where should we help them? Where should we go? Hey, sorry, somebody else going to have to help you. Should be where we have a legitimate national security interest. And I understand that, you know, we don't like terrorist organizations since 9/11, but not all of them have global reach, even if they profess to. And not all of them are capable of the 9/11 type experience. You know, can they all, over the internet, radicalize somebody here in the United States who does drive the car into a crowd or blows himself up? Yeah, probably. But that just may be the new norm. I hate to say it. Our defenses should be improved so we disrupt those plots when they occur here in the United States. to secure our fellow citizens. But again, you know, putting 10,000 troops, 100,000 troops, 50,000 troops, some all scattered across the globe, doing high intensity counterinsurgency against or counterterrorism operations against these forces, I think in the long run is not sustainable. That's my opinion.
When we get into these little they start as rhetorical events and then they get moving pretty quick. We have one going on with North Korea. We dance with the Chinese in the South China Sea. And then we also dance, in Eastern Europe with the Russians. When your military is tied up to a great extent in dealing with the global war on terrorism, and you've accepted that we're not going to be able to fight two wars simultaneously, so we've already discounted for that. You can't do both. You can't fight a peer, and you can't do the global war on terrorism simultaneously. How does that work? Is that just validating the point that you were just discussing in terms of you got to prioritize this stuff, and some of it you're going to have to live with and try to manage because you simply can't do it all. And that's, again, we're doing this now, and it is interesting given our states of readiness. Especially in the aviation community, and then seeing what's going on in the Korean Peninsula. If you were somebody that wanted to take on the United States, you know, you're seeing an organization in terms of the DOD that is stretched pretty thin, and that rubber band is going pretty fast.
Right. I think we have to, like I said, we have to come to terms with what the steady state security operations and our commitments are globally,
right,
with respect to violent extremist organizations. And so I think the sustainable strategy is by, with, and through partners and allies,
right,
enabling them to do things at a lower human and fiscal cost to us. That takes much longer because, you know, it's not like you're putting mass on a particular target, eradicating it, moving out. You're trying to keep it at a low boil and the lid on it so it doesn't impact the homeland while these people, you know, make their own country more secure, more safe. So, you know, it's a State Department problem with governance, policing, rule of law, and we provide the military aspect of that where we can, benefiting those partners in areas where we have strategic interest. Now, the peer competitor fight, that's a whole different ball game, as you know. And yeah, right now we've been at war fighting insurgents for 17 years. During that time we've taken a procurement holiday. We're right now readiness is bad, not because we don't know how to keep gear or maintain. It's because the gear's older. It takes more of an effort, more money to maintain it. We've had almost 10 years of sequester and flatline budgets. And so the fiscal resources haven't been there to modernize the force. And we're at a predicament where we probably, given the security situation and the threats we see globally, need to grow the force as well as modernize the force at the same time. And, you know, the last time I think we probably did that was, the last year or so of the Carter administration and the first several years, the first 4 years of the Reagan administration. And so it's been a long time since we injected the capital into the military in sufficient quantities to do both at the same time. So it's difficult. We're trying to manage that within the budgetary realities that we're forced to live with, sequester, and which is still in effect. The Budget Control Act has not been, it hasn't been repealed.
Right.
So, they've passed a authorization bill upwards of $700 billion, but there's no appropriations with that yet. So there's no money. And that's why we're in a CR, which kills us because you can't do new starts. You can't modernize the forest with continuing CRs. So we're probably not as ready as we'd like to be. We're not unready, but we don't have probably the capacity, obviously, to do, and we debate these things in open forum, right, which is not as great either, because the enemy can tune into C-SPAN and kind of understand where we're at.
Yeah, but you know what? But the enemy knows. I mean, they're not stupid, right? We're as transparent as we are. You know, what's interesting about our modern age is things the Russians could never even conceive of that they could do, right? Relative to espionage and things like that. The internet has delivered to their doorstep, you know, with very, very low risk to them and extreme. You talk about a leveraged operation, very low risk, very, very, you know, human centric and machine centric but relatively low in cost and out of this galaxy relative to return. And it's amazing when you think of it. It's absolutely amazing. And so it's, you know, our peers they know.
Right, and we're a sieve too. I get a news feed from DOD every day. And I was looking at it today, and I was briefed last week, taken into a SCIF or into a program, blah 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 blah. Today I read about it in the damn news thing. I'm like, what? You know, and was shocked me because of what they were talking about. And I'm like, well, how did that get out? So, yeah, we got a problem with that. But, yeah, our adversaries know. So, again, if they know, we look, and this is where we have strategic miscalculation, which is the thing that concerns probably most of us. Is that in the North Korean scenario, if they believe that we can't take them, rightly or wrongly, they can do things that will cause us to act. And if we deter them because they knew they could not succeed, maybe their behavior would be different. So when you see emboldened behavior, you have to ask yourself, is that because we're not deterring them anymore, or do they not fear us as much as they did 10 years ago? Is the technology just improved to the point where they have to test it? Do they want to get that threshold? I mean, I think they look at it is that, you know, they've seen Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi give up nuclear programs and then get their regimes flipped, and they both lost their lives. So the Kim regime is not going to do that. So we've got a problem.
The Dave Furness, Brigadier General Type, United States Marine Corps, is our guest. He working in Africa these days, and he's been doing explaining to us. Another email question. Mac, you had Mike Etor on last week, and you guys talked about leadership. I know a little bit about General Furness's background. He's a VMI guy. I'm curious about his thoughts on hazing. You said, and I think most Marines would agree with you, that you enjoyed the initiation rites that you went through as a Marine. And I think most of us agree with that. We didn't consider it hazing, whether it was our initiation, the first time we went to the field, the shell back ceremony, or hell, even getting your rank insignia pinned to your collarbone. It was all harmless, good guide type of fun, initiating you into either greater responsibility or deeper into the traditions of the seagoing service. I always enjoyed it. I'm curious because those things do get stupid. I quoted you in a couple of discussions. There's a big difference between crawling through garbage during the shellback ceremony and eating it. And I think that's very, very well said. I'm curious about his thoughts. It's so high profile now.
Well, I think anything you do to a teammate, I think there's different, like when you do shell back ceremonies, those were, like the whole unit was doing that. It was one of those things that kind of brought you closer together. You know, was it degrading? I mean, you didn't think so when you were going through it, but, you know, if you look at it from the outside, you probably looked at it that way. You know, hazing that, you know, we're trying to, that I think is a symptom of, like, poor leadership in the barracks or in the small unit, is where you're trying to, you know, drive a guy out of the unit, or you are setting a higher standard than the standard the Marine Corps set, or your squad, platoon, fire team, what have you. And you want to make everybody, you know, get over a different kind of bar. And when, you know, people struggle to do that, you do things to them that, would hurt them. Or, you know, it's basically shaming or ostracizing or physically abusing a teammate. And then asking that teammate to fight with you, I think it's just inconsistent with our ethos.
Okay, so
leaving a Marine behind.
Would you draw a line between initiations and hazing? Because I agree with you. The initiations I went through, I was when I went to the field, the first one I went through as a Marine. I'm trying to think. Yeah, the first one I went through as a Marine was Charlie Company 15, going to the field for the first time, and I don't know, there was probably about a dozen of us who were new to the company, and so we go over, and it's ACER, first time in the field, you're going to, you know, you have to go through the initiation. Okay, I'm in. Do you want to do psychological sit-ups or ETO qual? And I'm good at ETO, sounds kind of ominous. I'm good at sit-ups. I'll do sit-ups. That was a bad call. And so I said, what's the deal with psychological sit-ups? Well, we blindfold you and you'll get vertigo and nobody can get to 15. I'm like, I'll get to 15. I know that. I don't care if I have vertigo or not. And, right, so they start laying everything out. My company commander comes up to me, walks up behind me, and he says, you're not doing psychological sit-ups. I said, sir, I'm good at sit-ups. And he just looks at me and he said, Mac, it's an order. I said, yes, sir. I said, I'll eat to a qual. And they look, all right. So, right, ETO qual is, you know, they put a dime down. You're supposed to try to hit the dime. Once they blindfold everybody, they put your cover down there, and you hack it up, and you just smash it. And it's, you know, it's harmless fun, right? Initiation, welcome to Charlie Company. ETO, I mean, psychological sit-ups are, you know, somebody holds your feet, you do a couple practice ones, okay. Then the nastiest guy, you know, in the company squats over your head with his pants down, and you do a sit-up into the crack of his ass. Right now, that's pretty funny if you're not the guy doing the sit up. Okay, it's actually it's really funny. Okay, harmless though, right? Stupid harmless.
Look,
stupid,
I mean,
harmless fun.
You know, the emailer, I mean, knows I went to VMI. I mean, VMI, your whole first year, you're hate. So, I mean, drop for push ups. You know. Taken out of your rack in the middle of the night, taken to a room, and essentially worked out so you can't hold yourself off the floor, can't do another sit-up, can't get up, you know, muscle failure like you read about.
Right.
And so all that, I think in our organization, it doesn't have a purpose. And it looks like, from a professional warfighting standpoint, it looks like you're doing, pledging in a fraternity. And I think, with the advent of social media and, you know, every phone has a camera and all that other stuff, it's just, you know, harmless fun, as you know, in the Marine Corps tends to get out of control because we're young, 19 to 25. I think 61%, 70% of the Marine Corps is under the age of 25, mostly male. And it gets out of control very quickly. And so what was tolerated and maybe, and it tends to get over the years worse and worse and worse by generation. Like, it's not good enough anymore to hack an E-tool. You gotta, and then all of a sudden, you know, somebody loses a finger or whatever. so you stop it. I can remember.
Come on, you got you got 10 fingers. What are you like? Now we're gonna bitch about losing a finger? Come on.
But I'll give you another example. Like when you used to do the blood strike to the clavicles, right? Kneeing them in the side. And I had a particular young man that we were trying to get meritoriously promoted, and he was a great Marine, and we worked hard on boards, and finally he got meritoriously promoted. And in the, you know, everybody's so excited, so you have the, you hammer the corporal chevrons into his collar, and then he goes, all the NCOs get together and they line up, and he goes through the gauntlet, and everybody's kneeing him in the side of the leg, and he's a big guy, I mean, big, strong young man. And it tore his ACL. And so after that, I mean, he's tough. So he's like, he's got a torn ACL, and he's not going to medical. He's like, yeah, my knee kind of bothers me. And eventually, he had to go get surgery on it, and we lost him for the deployment. And so at that point, I just looked at it and said, that's never happening. And it was always one of these things that's just what happened. That's just what we did. And I said, we're not doing that in this platoon anymore. Never again in any unit. Because, you know, this guy, because we all went too far. It's different if you just, you know, kind of give him a half-hearted, you know, punch in the side. Everybody, so people are kneeing him and doing all that. It always gets out of control. And so over the years, we've had problems with it. And finally, it's like, no, you know. I can remember where it was okay, or it was tolerated, where NCOs would incentive PT. But again, it got out of control. Okay? And I listened to the podcast from, you know, Mike on 14 December, where he talks about what he did in his own company. And, you know, I did the same thing in mine. I saw when I first took over, it was a couple days, people were getting dropped left and right, and I pulled a guy and said, hey, why are you doing that? Well, he didn't know this. I said, have you taught him? No, I just dropped the push-ups. So you made his biceps and his chest stronger, but you didn't address the problem. You know, so I made him like, hey, look, if you're not doing that, okay, if he doesn't know something, teach it. Okay, if he dropped something, correct it. But you don't get to punish, which is what this is. And you got to step in and nip it in the bud as a commander. But what you've always said, and I've heard you say it on the program before, it's a symptom of piss poor junior leadership. Now, sometimes it's that you do not, you know, leaders don't feel they have any other tool but that. And that's a command problem of not empowering junior leaders enough to do it. You have to explain to them, hey, corporal, you don't get to punish, but you can do corrective action, and here's what is acceptable, and here's what's not, okay? And if you need assistance from senior staff NCOs, here's, you know, other tools that you have. But, I mean, there's, you know, in a rifle company, there's one guy can punish, it's the company commander. In a battalion, you know, it's the colonel. I mean, and that's just got to be the way it is, where you have the inmates running the asylum. You know, they... and you lose control of very quickly the barracks if you don't have good NCO and staff NCO leadership. So I hear you. Some initiation, right? The problem is they always go too far.
Right.
Somebody always gets hurt. That's why the shellback stuff now is so watered down.
Right.
You know what I mean? We literally hand a certificate out and you don't do anything.
Whoa. You know, and those were, but again, you know, I did it on an aircraft carrier, thousands of people, right? But, you know, we heard stories about, no, the problem are on some of those smaller ships when, yeah, we know we've done this before, we got it, and you don't have anybody supervising. I first saw the blood stripe thing after formation on the parade deck. It's not like this thing hid in the Marine Corps. It's the way you did it.
Right.
And I remember being a second lieutenant watching going, good God, what are they doing? Oh, it's just blood stripes, sir. And I said the same thing. I saw it one time, and I said, the first time somebody's injured doing that. Because you know the idiots that you have, right?
Right.
I had this kid named, he's a corporal named Hernandez, and his nickname was Herc, because he was as strong as Hercules. And he was dumb as a fence post. But I'll tell you what, he was tougher than anything. And Hernandez needs this kid and like to kill him. And I just looked at my staff sergeant and I said, you know, this is 1984 in the Marine Corps, right? Post-Vietnam Marine Corps. And I said, look, I don't know this history or tradition, but if anybody gets hurt, it's over. And the next time it happened, somebody got hurt, I said, it's over. Right now, I can't tell you that they didn't go out behind the barracks and do it, but nobody ever got hurt again about it, because I think that he knew that it would be his ass if somebody got hurt. And I also think that when we did it out in the open with staff NCOs standing around watching it, there was quote-unquote supervision of it. And it was, you know, you knew the stupid people that needed to be supervised, even in this drill. Hey, Furness, don't do it, because I'll have your ass, right? And then, if you don't have that, then you get what you get. I want to ask you a cultural question, and then I'm going to see if Rob Schwartz is going to join us. But are you in a hurry to get off?
No, I got nothing to do, buddy.
Okay, all right.
I don't know what time is it. It's 20:00 here.
Yeah, all right. All right. I'm going to ask you this question. We'll take a break. I'll get Schwartz on, and then we'll do the command element of RCT 1 2010-2011 segment of the program. We have young people that come from a culture that doesn't embrace discipline and doesn't embrace structure. And we bring them into an environment that requires structure and discipline. But the people in the Marine Corps are the same people that are raising these kids. And they're, you know, you hear these terms, helicopter parents, and so it seems to me, if I wouldn't, and the more I study this, junior staff NCO leadership or junior NCO, or I would say specifically sergeant leadership in the Marine Corps and staff sergeant leadership in the Marine Corps, coupled with intermediate level officers who give up standards and structure too easily because they don't want to be that guy.
Right.
Are having a hugely negative impact, because these young people that are coming into the Marine Corps, they need structure. They need discipline because they've never really had it. And so we give it to them at boot camp, and if it doesn't sustain itself in measured, responsible leadership, like I think has always been the case, then the downside of these young people is much further. And so I want your thoughts on that. And I'm going to give you an example of junior officer leadership. One of my sons, I won't tell you which one, tells a story about there was a saying that comes from a book that Marines read. And it was, but they were using it in a derogatory way towards the leadership of their company. And they put
I heard this with the mother.
Yeah, right. I used it to him. Right. And they put it on a platoon PT shirt. So it was this encrypted insult that they would wear to PT.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so he sees it, and he gets them all together, and he says, those will never be worn again. Do you understand? And, you know, then you just get, nobody says a word, right? And they're also looking at you. Everybody nod your head. Those will never, ever be worn again on this base. You're Americans. I can't control what you wear outside. But I know what you're doing, and it's disrespectful. Now, I don't know if those leaders are fewer and farther between to do the right thing and to get everybody to say, "What? He's such an asshole." Right. Right.
Right.
But the young people that are coming in to this Marine Corps are more comfortable with that and less comfortable with the structure and discipline that we provide. Your thoughts on either the balance that goes there or our kind of crumbling infrastructure of discipline in the Marine Corps? Because if you look at the other services, they're struggling with it mildly. The Navy, I mean, good God.
Right.
So your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the thinking you have to do is you assume that, you know, your son was probably if I'm a helicopter, you know, if I'm a helicopter parent, I'm an attack helicopter parent. So, you know, and you're probably the same way. So I love the stories that you were telling Mike about how we were raised, because I think we were all raised fairly consistently. And so for me, and probably you, when we joined the Marine Corps, it wasn't that much different than being at home. I mean,
no,
you know,
it wasn't.
So, I mean, we had, except the uniforms. And I think that's a lot different than today. I think you have to spend time as a commander developing your junior leaders. You have to spend a lot of time talking and showing, modeling, coaching how to do these things. What the unit will do, what the unit won't be. I mean, that's what, essentially, what, you know, Sergeant Major Zickafus and I did, you know, 20 to 25 days a month, you know, we were gone from Dwyer, is going around inspecting and teaching and modeling leadership. And, you know, the flat-ass rules of RCT1 were all things that in the first month we saw and we were trying to correct. So first you put out guidance, here, don't do this, do this. And then you got to go around and check, and then you got to model. And then if you remember, there was a lieutenant, it turned out to be a pretty good lieutenant, but we showed up one day, and he was, you know, messed up as Hogan's go. And I told him, I brought him aside, I went around and pointed everything that was not to standard that I saw. And I said, you're going to fix this, and I'm going to be back in 2 weeks. And if you don't have it fixed in 2 weeks, I'm putting you in the back of this rig, and I'm sending you home. Because Marines are not your training aid. And you're going to get these guys killed if you don't get your together. And sometimes in combat, you have a very thin line, because it is life and death. You have to develop those skills, and you develop them with the best combat units are the most disciplined combat units. That's what, you know, 7 combat events have taught me. And it really came home in spades in RCT1. The better, you know, because 12 battalions cycled underneath us in a span of a year, and you could see the imprint of the commander, the better disciplined units, the better staff NCO, NCO-led units were more successful. They had less casualties. They didn't do stupid things that made them vulnerable to the Taliban. And so, but that has to be instilled from the first, everything they do in the unit. You know, Zickafus would call it the basic daily routine. You know, how a unit moves through the day, how they pass the word, how they inspect each, you know, their rooms, their weapons, their kit, their equipment, everything. I mean, that's how you instill it. And, you know, sometimes instilling that is not a pleasant process. It's, you know, clean your room, fail them twice, third time you got it, okay, let's not do it that way ever again. And you consistently hold them to a standard. It's always correcting something that's not happening the way it's supposed to happen. You know, I used to say, and you probably heard me say this, it's like, you don't get to choose which order or directive you want to follow, devil dog. But you're following them all. And you just keep preaching that, and you tell the NCOs, you're the guy who's got to correct it. Why am I correcting it? You know, I'm here with the Sergeant Major and Colonel, why am I correcting it? That should be you corrected. And over time, I tell you, the proud, I told this story a lot. I said, the proudest day of my life is CO First Marines. I'm running through the gym slowly. And, I've got, and I hate tucking my PT shirt in. But the regulations say, your PT shirt is supposed to be tucked in. It's on the green on green uniform. So I'm running out there and I've got my PT shirt tucked in. And I got this sergeant running at me like, you know, I'm running for a touchdown, he's got the angle, and he's going to blow me out of bounds. And he pulls up to me, and I stop, and he's like, sir, I need to talk to you. I go, yeah, what's up? And he's like, hey, you got to tuck your shirt in, sir. And I go, yes, I do. Tuck my shirt in, went to the gym. And I know it was like, hey, you know, because I was busting on every little thing that was wrong, you're correcting it. That's right. The first thing.
Well, and this is the structure that I'm talking about. Talk about the struggle to do green on green PT during working hours. But first of all, explain everybody what we're talking about, because some of it's in code. Green on green is, go ahead, explain it.
Green shorts, green t-shirt, it's the PT uniform of the Marine Corps.
Hold on.